Nemoto presents filmmaking giants. Sergei Eisenstein, montage. Narrated with Microsoft Azure using the Christopher voice. Running time, approximately 33 minutes. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants. Yesterday we stood in the hot rooms of early American cinema and watched a new grammar for storytelling assemble itself out of cuts and glances. Today we step into a workshop where cuts do not simply connect one view to another. They collide, argue, and give birth to new thought. Our guide is Sergei Eisenstein, engineer's son, theater tinkerer, circus lover, student of revolution, who treated editing not as glue but as a mind. If D.W. Griffith taught audiences to accept the invisible seam, Eisenstein pulled the seam into the light and turned it into a spark. In his hands, the splice itself speaks. He did not arrive with the camera already in his pocket. He learned his trade in the charged air of the 1910s and 1920s, when Russia's old world had been blown open and artists were trying to find forms adequate to a new history. He trained as an engineer because that kept parents calm and because the country needed bridges. He haunted theaters and circus rings because that is where bodies and rhythm could be measured without hypocrisy. The mix, math and spectacle, stayed with him. He worked in the Moscow Proletcult, stages turned into laboratories where audiences did not need velvet but did require energy. From there to film was a jump sideways, not upward, a change of instrument, not of ambition. He wanted to discover how images could be arranged so that a viewer did not only follow but thought. In 1923, he wrote a phrase that sounds like a fairground and reads like a program, the montage of attractions. Attraction for him was not charm, it was a unit of sensory impact, a jolt. Stack your jolts intelligently, tonally, rhythmically, thematically, and you can direct the audience's energy to a designed end. It began as a stage theory, but the camera let it become a grammar. The point was not to comfort people into agreement. The point was to wrestle them into recognition. In a theater, you could shake a spectator by altering light and tempo. On a strip of film, you could control the tremor down to the frame. He made his first feature strike as if it had been pent up and needed to get out in a rush. The story is plain. A factory, a wage cut, a rising, a betrayal. But the telling is a workshop in how images can think by collision. Faces are typage, not stars. A foreman's sneer is a geometry. A crowd is a body with joints. He cuts from a worker's crushed hand to a manager's fat cigar, and the cut itself is the accusation. He lets factory machinery glint like teeth and then, late in the film, gives the audience a parallel it cannot politely ignore, the slaughter of cattle intercut with the suppression of strikers. For some viewers, the metaphor will always feel brutal. He meant it to. For him, inserting the abattoir was not an ornament but an argument. That systems eat. You can push against the tactic. Argue that such cutting risks simplifying a conflict to an appetite. He would answer that metaphor is a tool only the honest can use without fraud, so do the work to earn it. He tried to earn it by staging bodies in ways that made forces visible. Economics in a gesture, class in a corridor, the state in a line of boots. He had theories for everything because theory was, in those years, an ethical act. A promise that you were not just producing effects but articulating grounds. In essays later collected as Film Form and the Film Sense, he divided montage into species by how it ordered time. Metric montage, cutting at fixed lengths of film, organizes a beat with a metronome's indifference to content. Rhythmic montage ties the cut to movement inside the frame. Tonal montage cuts according to the emotional temperature of a sequence. Overtonal montage layers the previous three so that mood and motion and counting argue with one another. Intellectual montage, the one that made his name among readers, splices images for the sake of an idea. It sounds like a taxonomy invented for a lecture hall. On screen, it is closer to a composer's rehearsal. He wanted filmmakers to be able to feel whether to change the shot because a line of rifles had finished its arc or because a face had finished a phrase even though no word had been spoken. His second feature, Battleship Potemkin, is often treated as a single staircase with a cradle rolling down it. The Odessa Steps sequence is only one of the film's five movements, but it has carried the public memory because it compresses his intentions into a piece of time that feels physically inescapable. The sailors, provoked beyond obedience, revolt. Their ship becomes a floating republic. The city gathers to salute. The state sends soldiers to remind citizens that legs and columns can be an instrument of law. The steps run from a sea road toward a broad square. On those steps, order and panic make a duet you cannot comfortably hum. Boots descend in a steady lattice. The crowd stumbles in stuttering syncopation. A mother lifts a child above the human tide, as if air could be spared if it is held high. A woman in pince-nez and educated face is shot. Her glasses shatter. The lens notices a line of blood delicate as enamel. A pram begins to roll. A man, masked as a 21st century riot policeman would be masked, breaks the smooth void of his visor with a sword that is also a straight edge across the screen. Each gesture is a unit. The units accumulate a logic. You could not describe the argument before it happens, but the body in watching became its scribe. An authority without eyes is a geometry without pity. A crowd without a center falls. If we do not learn to hold one another on stairs, the incline will teach us its lesson the hard way. Critics who distrust the scene call it manipulative, and they are right because manipulation here means arranging experience so that a spectator cannot remain distant. You would not deny it. You would claim that the ethics live in the telos. Toward what end do you urge the viewer's heart to beat? He believed himself to be in the service of revolutionary humanism, not merely of a party's slogans. History in its darker hours argued with him. Censors did more than argue. He learned what it was to revise, to defend, to recant a preface to get a film released, and to bear the knowledge that images you have made can become instruments for someone else's narrower will. He did not, in later years, give up the conviction that collision could educate. He sharpened it at cost. Between Strike and Potemkin sits the shorter piece Old and New, retitled The General Line, where he tries to make policy visible at the scale of a peasant's hand. Cream separator machines spin like auroras. Cows are celebrated like the saints of a new liturgy. A woman's hope is not sentimental but mechanical. He wanted to build films where matter and meaning were married. For him, the camera was not a window but a lever. Move it and the world might move. He used typage not because he despised performers but because he trusted bodies that carried their class and labor in their shoulders. He wanted faces that would read like an illuminated manuscript. A farmer's cheekbones under a winter hat, a policeman's boredom while he does something terrible, a party official's seriousness without depth. He risked caricature in order to avoid the lie of neutrality. The risk is visible now in places where he arranged a face to stand in for a mass. In that overconfidence, too, is a lesson. A film's ambition to speak for many is always balanced against its failure to contain them. He had rivals and friends and an ecosystem in which people argued without ending friendships. Pudovkin, Kulshov, Vertov. These names are not footnotes. They are neighboring laboratories. Kulshov demonstrated that viewers read emotion into a neutral face depending on what image followed it. Pudovkin wrote about linkage and taught cuts to be bridges rather than collisions. Vertov wanted to reveal the apparatus and let the city be its own protagonist. Eisenstein's essays sometimes thumped the table, insisting on dialectic where colleagues asked for chain. In practice, the films borrow from each other. October looks like a hymn to shattering and is in fact carefully stitched. A bridge opens. A horse is trapped. Images of a god's face towering over a crowd are divided into fragments until the continuity of holiness collapses, and then the fragments become a new, democratized iconography. It is less thrilling now than it was then, because we have learned to mistrust sequences in which sacred things are deconstructed for applause. Strip away the antique posture and the craft remains instructive. Show, fracture, reassemble. Teach the eye how belief is made and unmade. He wrote, even then, about sound. When synchronized sound arrived, many directors treated it as a coat, a layer to be thrown over the body to keep weather out. He insisted that sound and image must be cut against each other like two voices in a fugue, sometimes in harmony and sometimes at war. Alexander Nevsky, made with Prokofiev in 1938, is his living proof. The battle on the ice is music for metal and mass. Chords shudder when a line breaks, strings sharpen when a spear finds a fault. Silence becomes a weapon. The human voice enters the space like a new texture rather than a royal decree. You hear in that film the vertical montage he had named, the stacking of sound events into a column that is edited with the same attention as the timeline of vision. Later, in Ivan the Terrible, he used sound to make a court feel like a throat. Choked, wheezing, singing sometimes because speaking openly would be suicide. In part two, when he switched to color for a stretch, he treated the pigments like instruments too. The red is not crimson, it is accusation. Gold is not wealth, it is rot. He could be operatic to a fault, but the purpose is consistent. Everything, cut, composition, costume, chant, is ordered toward meaning that can be felt before it is parsed. Between those state-sanctioned epics sits a countervailing chapter, his trip west. He signed with Paramount, came to Hollywood, drew storyboards for projects that executives admired like sketches in a gallery without the nerve to fund. He made friends, enemies, lectures, studios nervous. He went south to Mexico with Upton Sinclair's support to make Que Viva Mexico, a film meant to be a living mural of fiesta, labor, ritual, death, love. He shot miles of footage and was recalled before he could assemble them. The pieces were edited without him into versions he disowned. His notebooks from that time read like a man learning a new language under pressure. He is fascinated with faces that had little place in Hollywood movies at that hour. He is entranced by masks that, on his return, will perhaps become too tempting. He is in love with the possibilities of a cinema that does not need intertitles because the cut can carry metaphysics as easily as plot. The broken project is also a testimony to how fragile grand designs are when money and politics collide. He came back to the USSR wiser, chastened, stubborn as before. His last years were an argument with the state that also paid his bills. Part 1 of Ivan the Terrible pleased the leader because a brooding monarch who consolidates power looks like a precedent worth respecting. Part 2 displeased for the same reason. The mirror began to show too much. The film was shelved. Parts 1 and 2 formed a hinge in a career that had already learned the rhythm of advance and suspension. He taught at VGIK in Moscow, and the students who left his classroom carried a discipline about cuts that few schools in the world would equal. He wrote drafts about everything, Disney's animation as a compendium of metaphors, architecture as a staging of bodies, the way the human eye seeks diagonals and finds reassurance in symmetry until symmetry becomes sterile. He left behind not only films but a way of reading. Look for the argument made by arrangement. What does that give you if you do not plan to make a montage film about revolution? Quite a bit. First, the courage to treat editing as thought, not as transportation. In a documentary about a clinic, the cut from a doctor's hand washing to a patient's shoes is not filler. It is a sentence, and your meaning depends on how you count it. In a courtroom scene, the decision to let a pause breathe before you show a juror is an ethical choice, not a convenience. If you discover, in assembling a scene, that you can produce tears by ranking shots in a certain order, you owe the audience a reckoning free of vanity. To what end do you want those tears? He teaches the craft and issues the warning at the same time. Skill is a form of power, and power asks to be justified. Second, a discipline about rhythm that respects both body and thought. He knew that you can count your way into a crowd's pulse, cut every X frames, and he knew, even as he named metric montage, that this rule becomes a tyrant if you let it. The better rhythm is found at the intersection of count and content. A boot's length, a shoulder's slump, a banner's crack in a crosswind, a line of music that refuses to resolve. That respect for embodied time travels well outside public squares. A conversation in a kitchen has a mathematics, too. A clasping of a mug, a gaze to the floor, a breath longer than apology. Learn to cut by what the body is doing and you will avoid the glide that disrespects it. Third, an invitation to think with juxtaposition without abusing it. The slaughterhouse intercut with a crackdown became, in lesser hands, a hack's way of making anything look like anything else. He would be partly to blame for the trend and entirely opposed to its laziness. His example challenges you to earn your metaphor. If you cut a river through a boardroom, the river must do more than hiss at suits. It must show, in the movement of eddies, in the carving of banks, something about time and patience and persistence that your human scene has refused to say plainly. If you cannot make that case, find a humbler device. Fourth, a seriousness about sound that avoids the sticky wallpaper of background music. Vertical montage is not a slogan, it is a task. Let the air conditioner hum stand against a line of dialogue so the room feels aged. Let a distant train shriek across a close-up so a face mirrors a landscape under pressure. Let silence descend not at a period but at a comma so the crowd leans forward with you instead of thinking you are finished. If you learn to cut sound and image as equal citizens, you will escape the tyranny of music as anesthetic and discover music as muscle. Fifth, a candor about propaganda, not as a foreign species but as one of the possible fates of all eloquence. He did not think of himself as a propagandist in the pejorative sense. He believed in persuasion as the honorable work of public art. He believed also in a public art patronized by a state that wanted pictures to behave. The gap between those beliefs is where both his triumphs and his compromises live. For you, long after those particular quarrels cooled, the use is a habit. When you detect that your film, your memo, your sermon, your essay has become too good at moving people in a direction that makes your life simpler, stop and test the joints. Is the eloquence serving truth, or is it hiding your appetite? You would recognize the question. He might dislike its tone. He would respect its necessity. He died in 1948, not yet 50, in Moscow, with a draft of a book about Disney on his desk and drawings still damp with ideas. He left behind films that people think they have seen even when they have only seen their fragments in other people's work. He left behind, too, a phrase that is easy to repeat and worth sharpening, montage, and a method that still demands sweat. It is a method that gives you permission to build an argument with images and not apologize for wanting the audience to feel the thought. It is also a method that requires you to account for the thought you intend to feel. If we lay his voice beside the others we have gathered, the quiet order of Confucius, the refusal to humiliate of Shah Waliullah, the disciplined courage of Iqbal, the open sky pedagogy of Tagore, you see not a contradiction but a chorus. He adds a craft that makes public feeling intelligible. Arrange, collide, resolve, teach the eye that meaning often appears where things meet and not where they sit alone. Used gently, this craft allows a classroom film to teach patience. Used precisely, it allows a city to see its own habits. Used viciously, it allows a lie to march in the uniform of clarity. The craft does not change. The hands do. So the practice I want to carry into your day is small and surgical. When you edit anything, a message, a policy memo, an episode, pick one place where the audience's heart moves and name what moved it. A cut to a child's hand, a sound that covered a face, a juxtaposition that felt like a syllogism. Write it down beside the timeline. Ask yourself what you are asking that heartbeat to do for you. If the answer is serviceable and honest, cut on. If the answer embarrasses you, this is the place to choose differently. It is a simple ritual of oath-taking, learned from a man who built cathedrals out of frames and who knew, and sometimes forgot, how dangerous a splendid cathedral can be. Thank you for listening to this episode of Eastern Philosophy for Beginners. F. W. Murnau. Hello and welcome back to Filmmaking Giants. We end our first block in the glow and chill of German light, where shadows stretch like thoughts and the camera, freed from its post, begins to move as if it has lungs. Friedrich Wilhelm Murnau did not write a manifesto. He built one with lamps and lenses. If Eisenstein made montage into a philosophy of collision, Murnau made the moving shot into a philosophy of attention. He did not strip away cutting, he tamed it. He treated space as a sentence and light as grammar, and he asked the camera to behave like a companion who breathes beside a character rather than a god who pronounces from a corner. He was trained on stages where Max Reinhardt taught directors to think with light and bodies, not only with words. He lived in rooms where painters moved furniture and windows so that the angle of a wall could carry an emotion. Expressionism, which critics often reduced to tilted sets and dark makeup, was in his hands a discipline about inner states made visible. He came to film when that discipline found a lens. He understood, early, that the lens is not a passive eye but a maker of space. Place the camera low and a door grows moral. Place it high and a city flattens into a plan. Move it at shoulder height and the viewer begins to recognize human scale. His early films, The Ones Lost, The Ones Fragmentary, The Apprenticeships, taught him restraint. He adapted Tartuffe with a sly frame story that turns a moral tale about a hypocrite into a lesson about how images can unmask a household. He tried Naturalism and Journey into the Night, a title that promises melodrama and gets, instead, a patient attention to how a decision gathers. But Nosferatu is where the world first registered what he had learned. The story is a stolen Dracula, names changed and lawsuits to come, but the method is original. Sunlight is not salvation. It is the instrument that reveals how fragile skin is. He films daylight with dread, and he uses shadow like a handwriting. The vampire's outline stretches across a wall before the body enters. A staircase becomes a graph of fear. A ship crosses water like a rumor of death. The effects are simple. Stop motion for a coffin, self-propelled glide, trick exposure for the ghostly, but the atmosphere is not a trick. He makes a town feel porous. you can sense the air changing in a room before a door opens. He had learned to use weather as a character and furniture as an accomplice. You are not watching a monster, you are watching the way loneliness makes space hollow. He then made a film with barely a handful of intertitles, because he wanted to prove that faces and movement could speak a complete syntax. The Last Laugh, Der Letzte Mann in German, The Last Man Really, follows a proud hotel doorman whose job is almost a uniform of being. He is old enough for the heavy coat to look heavier. He is demoted without ceremony, the coat is taken, the man is returned to the back corridor. The camera, mounted on a sled and a bicycle and a chest harness and sometimes simply carried by a man with carefully bent knees, glides through doors, circles a desk, rocks with a walk. The motion is not decorative. It is the old man's balance. When he is dismissed, the lens trembles slightly. When he dreams, it floats. Karl Freund, the cinematographer, called it the unchained camera because the tripod had been treated like an altar from which you were not allowed to remove the instrument. They removed it. The resulting images feel like the invention of a new sense. You are not looking at him, you are inside the dignity he is losing. He staggers, and the horizon staggers with him. People sometimes talk about pure cinema as if it were an excuse to avoid content. Murnau makes the opposite case. He argues, with shots and light, that the purity sought is not emptiness but concentration. In The Last Laugh, there is an indulgent epilogue, a fantasy of riches that producers required and critics dismissed, but the body of the film remains a lesson in how to build meaning without speech. A doorknob fills the frame with the gravity of a verdict. A glass of beer becomes a sentence of defeat. A backyard wedding dances under stringed bulbs that make poverty look like a holiday because it is, and because even humiliation has afternoons. The camera watches without pity and without spite. It lets a person's small pride take up the exact amount of room it needs. He could stage the elemental without losing intimacy. Faust begins with clouds wrestling under an enormous cross, devils dealing in scrolls, and the universe itself turned into a room for an argument about the price of a soul. He layers exposure so that a face can be sky. He drapes capes so that a gesture can be weather. He uses light beams like diagonals in a painting to draw attention where it must go. The film, now, feels like a pageant with a very strict conscience. It also feels like a director trying to find the scale at which metaphysics can be shown without laughter. He succeeds because he respects gravity. The devil is not a cartoon, he is a negotiator. The pious are not furniture, they are obstacles and friends. He is discovering how to make films where philosophy does not sit on a stool reciting but walks around dressed in boots. The move to America did not tame him. Fox gave him resources he could convert into craft and asked, politely, for prestige. He made Sunrise, a song of two humans, and gave the studio both. The plot is a fable with footprints. A farmer, tempted by a city woman, plots to drown his wife and cannot, and the day that follows is a long learning to be simple again. What makes the film inexhaustible is not its moral, which is righteous in an uncomplicated way, but its method. He builds sets that do not pretend to be real. They pretend to be remembered. Streets widen at moments of reconciliation. Funfair corridors narrow when nerves return. Signs are hand-lettered. A pig gets drunk. He layers exposure so that the city woman appears like a weather system inside the farmer's head. He photographs a marsh so that seduction becomes mist. He builds a trolley ride that is less a commute than a liturgy. When the couple in the city enters a church and stumbles into a wedding service, their decision to rebind themselves arrives not as contrivance but as relief articulated by space. A long aisle, a hand held harder than is polite, a camera that does not object to pausing. He avoids intertitles for long stretches because he has made the camera fluent. Faces speak, angles sing, light asks questions and answers some of them. The Fox style that critics later named soft light, gauze where necessary, glamour when purchased, looks different under his governance. He uses the tools of glamour for tenderness and conscience. He loves backlight because it separates a person from a wall with a halo, and that halo can be forgiveness. He loves fog because it lets a transition happen in front of you without the vulgarity of a shutter. He loves movement that has a purpose. Diagonal tracks used to gather a room into an embrace, horizontal drifts used to let the eye travel from a face to a hand without being told where to look. And he uses water like time. When a storm comes, and it must, it is a story, not an effect. The rescue sequence does in water what Griffith's rescues did on roads and rails, but the feeling here is of characters earning their survival by learning their scale. The camera moves, yes, but it does not swoop for bravado. It accompanies. Sunrise arrived at the first Academy Awards and won an honor that was given only once, unique and artistic picture. Because the industry could already tell that this was a film that would educate it. It has educated it still. Every time a director trusts a long take to carry a reconciliation that lesser work would drown in speeches, the lesson is alive. Every time a city is built as an emotional machine rather than a backdrop, someone is borrowing from Murnau. He did not intend to stop. He wanted to shoot in Polynesia with Robert Flaherty, the documentarian of Nanook, to see whether drama could be pulled from a life without being extracted by force. The collaboration frayed. Flaherty preferred to watch. Murnau preferred to shape. They parted. Murnau finished Taboo with Floyd Crosby behind the camera. The film begins with play, young people diving, a shark that is both neighbor and threat, and darkens into a fable about a girl declared sacred to a tribe's tradition, forbidden to marry, desired by a youth who cannot convert desire into politics. Colonial traders hover at the edges like a second hunger. Money becomes a vocabulary that ruins everything it names. The images are not exoticism, they are stone cold. A sail moves across a horizon like a blade. A reef that was childish risk becomes a verdict. The ending is so simple that synopses spoil it just by existing. What matters is that he allows the ocean to have the last sentence and that the sentence's grammar is old as breath. He died in a car crash a week before the premiere, a young man still, with pages in his pocket and a craft that had just discovered how well it could travel. What, then, is his method as something you could adopt without a studio or a soundstage? First, the moving shot as attention, not as display. If your camera moves, it must move for a reason the scene recognizes, to collect a thought that is distributed across faces and objects, to allow a corridor to be walked without chopping the walk into confusing pieces, to give an actor the room to decide. The famous unchained camera was not a daredevil's toy, it was an ethic. It said, "Let the viewer's head remain on the shoulders of a human height. Let the eye have the dignity of a body again." It remains the antidote to the modern plague of wandering shots that sigh, "Look at me," while saying nothing. When you ask your camera to move, ask what it is keeping company with. Second, the frame is sentence, not as window. He composes with diagonals because the eye needs invitations and diagonals invite. He plants a vertical where you should feel an obstacle. He uses backlight to grant a person the little sovereignty they will need to apologize. He allows darkness to be not ignorance but rest. You can imitate this not by buying a fog machine but by thinking as he thought. If the line of the table were a clause, which way would it lean? Does a lamp make a promise? When you walk into a room in your own life, you already think this way. You notice whether the chairs face one another, whether the window is behind or in front of a friend's eyes. He made a cinema that dignifies that native perception. Third, the reduction of speech to where it is needed. Silent films did not need to be silent. Intertitles could chatter. He declined chatter because faces are heard before they are read. His talky plans suggest he would have used dialogue like a garnish on a meal that is mostly light and motion. In your work, whether you make films or write memos, this reduction is the craft that makes attention possible. Say fewer words because you have made the other elements eloquent. Fourth, the elemental is actor. Water has timing. Wind has opinion. Light has mood. He directs them. He lets linen speak. He lets a hat shrink a man by 2 inches. He lets a coat become a law. In the last laugh, the absence of a coat is the negative space of an entire life. This is not fetishism. It is noticing. In offices and homes alike, lives are conducted among things. A director who arranges things cares for people. When you watch your own room and find that an object dishonors someone by refusing to help them be themselves, you have learned his ethic in domestic form. Fifth, humility about the miraculous. Faust has devils and crosses. Nosferatu has a monster with fingers like pencils. Sunrise has a storm that arranges repentance. Taboo has taboos. He does not present these miracles as interruptions but as the ordinary drama of a world that contains law, custom, appetite, forgiveness. The miraculous is not magic. It is meaning discovered at scale. You can import that habit into secular stories by refusing to pity your characters. He never pities. He protects dignity by how he looks, not by what he says. A word about the ethics of the gaze. He filmed faces as if they were architectures anyone could learn to read. He filmed women without eating them. He filmed poor people without shrinking them into metaphors. He filmed a vampire without making love to him. In his company, the camera is a guest who knows how to leave. That restraint is not coyness. It is respect turned into form. If you adopt only that from him, your lens behaving with courtesy, you will have already improved the rooms you enter. He is sometimes accused of prettiness. The accusation is lazy, but it points to a real danger that he himself patrolled. A love of light can slip into kitsch if light is used to flatter. He rarely flatters. He emboldens. When he delights, lamps in a dance garden, reeds on a lake, a silhouette in dawn. He does so to make the moment accurate, not merely pleasing. The emotional truth of a place, for him, is its beauty. The copyists forget the truth and keep the shine. The cure is his patience. Let the shot hold long enough for the shine to become structure. He has no manifesto in his mouth but a map in his hand. If you lay that map across our earlier guides, you will find it covers the same country by a different route. Confucius asks that rooms train the heart. Murnau arranges rooms so that the heart has room to grow. Laozi asks you to feel the grain of things and move with it. Murnau shows you the grain by making a table's edge a line of force. Dogen trains attention in a kitchen. Murnau trains attention in a doorway. Ibn Khaldun speaks of the way institutions make or unmake dignity. Murnau shows an institution, the hotel, telling the truth about a man only after it has stripped him. Tagore designed a school without walls. Murnau designs a shot without barriers. He died too soon, which is a sentence critics write to tidy up their grief. It is also a technical fact. There are films in his notes that we will never see, and among them might have been lessons that would have spared us some of the uglier habits of the camera in the television age. Even without those unwritten chapters, the education he leaves is ample. It asks you to notice again. It asks you to move more slowly. It teaches you, in an art worshipped for speed, that stillness in motion is where the day's meaning often sits. So, take a small assignment into your afternoon. Walk through one room, a clinic, a studio, a kitchen, a classroom, and make it speak without words. Turn a chair. Move a lamp. Choose a height and keep it. Watch what that does to the way people treat one another. Then, if you have a camera, rehearse a single moving shot that is exactly as long as a thought. Keep it steady enough to be trusted and alive enough to be human. When you have done that, you will not simply have imitated Murnau. You will have learned what he taught. That attention, paid truly, is a kind of love, and that love, in pictures as in houses, is what makes freedom visible. Thank you for listening to this episode of Filmmaking Giants.